Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World. It is trite but true that youth are our future. Unfortunately, what is also true is that in many, perhaps most countries, the mental health of young people has been declining over the past two decades, a decline that seems to have accelerated during and after COVID. Globally, one in seven 10 to 19-year-olds reportedly experience mental disorder. In turn, depression, anxiety, behavioral issues are among the leading causes of illness, disability, and even suicide among adolescents. That is particularly a problem in Africa. 60% of Africans are under 24, and too many are victims of a witch's brew of climate shock, inflation, economic mismanagement, war, gang violence, epidemics, and other disasters. The resulting high incidence of youth with serious and enduring mental health disorders not only mortgages their own futures, but their country's futures as well. What can be done? Are there adequate resources, medical professionals, hospitals, targeted programs, overall money, focused on the challenges of youth mental health? Is there enough research based on conditions in Africa as opposed to extrapolations of data gathered and theories created in Europe or in the United States? Is there a real urgency among policymakers around the continent? Do the professionals know what needs to be done? Dr. Olayanka Amagboden founded the Center for Child and Adolescent Mental Health at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, where today she is provost of the College of Medicine, the first woman to hold that position. She has devoted her life to trying to answer those and other questions about adolescent mental health. Welcome, Olayanka, to New Thinking for a New World.
Thank you very much, Alan. It's an absolute delight to be here. One of the things that I have said repeatedly is that our children's mental health is our nation's future wealth. Our children's mental health is the nation's, and I would say the continent's, future wealth. And I think this, unfortunately, many don't understand the links between mental health and wealth. Because one of the things that I, you know, in my little world, I would say, or global world of, you know, going around and working with children, adolescents, youth, and young adults, is I have seen a link between mental health and the nation's wealth and productivity. And so I know that there's a bit of a crisis, or I would say not a bit, there's a huge crisis of mental health right here in my nation, Nigeria, and on the African continent, because we are largely a youthful population, as you have said. But unfortunately, the investments that should be made to ensure that the children of yesterday, the youth who actually hold the nation's future and present, should have the best foundations is not being the focus of many of our policymakers and leaders. Many times when you talk about mental health, the first thing we think about, or many people think about, is illness. But that's not what mental health is. Mental health is everyone's need. Everyone needs mental health. When you talk about mental health, optimal psychological functioning.
Olayanka, let me ask you sort of a rooting question in this sense. The problems you've described in your country, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Africa as a whole, clearly also are evident in other parts of the world. So let's start at that 60,000 foot level with this question. Is there something about how we are experiencing modernity in Nigeria, in Africa, in the world, that has created the conditions for so much stress, so many mental health challenges among our youth globally? What do you think?
I think the youth, particularly in my country and on the African continent, are facing, I would say, a conflict in many ways. First of all, there are the problems in the African continent and my country of poverty. You have up to 70%. And of course, you know, poverty and mental health are Siamese twins. The much higher rates in slums of mental health conditions. So we're facing underemployment, unemployment, problems of psychoactive substance use. We are facing large problems of war, terrorism. I'll give a, you know, one of the things I had said 20, 30 years ago was that I never thought we would have suicide bombers in my nation. I felt my country, that we loved life too much, but I was wrong, because there's been so much change that in the last couple of years, we've seen young people get strapped up and move into marketplaces and be, you know, to destroy and be destroyed. So we're facing those problems of poverty, problems of unemployment, lack of education. We have the highest numbers in Nigeria, like, and, you know, of street children, out of school children. All these are related to mental health. Child marriages, that is children under the age of 17 who are married, particularly the girls. And then at the same time, we're at the age of social media. So the children in my country, which we have a population of well over 200 million, and of course in most parts of sub-Saharan Africa, are facing and trying to struggle with poverty and hunger. But at the same time, there's the internet age, the social media that is coming in and is exposing them to things that they never would have seen. And this is leading to a great unrest. The youth are angry because right there in the past, it was just me and my village. I didn't know what was going on globally. But now the social media has changed perspectives so that young people can see what is happening in other climes. They are now able to compare themselves and wonder, what's going on with me here? Why am I like this? And so many other aspects that have come in with the internet age. They're now exposed to areas like, oh, wow, I can do this. I can get this online. I can get this through social media. So the children in my country, the youth in my country, are at, I would say, a period of great conflict like never before.
So that's the problem. And I'm so glad you brought in social media, because that is one of the bits of connective tissue that links Nigeria to Colombia, to the United States, to Japan. It is, because kids see the world and then they look at their own reality. Let's segue then to, that's the problem. We see it getting worse and worse. We see the consequences both at the individual level and, as you said, at the national level. What are the solutions? How do you, as a professional who's devoted your life to understanding both problem and potential solution, what do you do?
Yes. I, as a mental health professional working with young people, the first thing is that we need to realize that it's really not about resources. It's about getting resourceful at this time to deal with these conflicting issues of young people trying to break loose from their backgrounds, because a couple of decades ago, or even as now, the society in which we are in Africa is what we call a collectivistic society, where the elders had taught that if I say this, the youth must obey. But now that is changing. It's now the youth's eyes are gradually being opened through social media. And they're realizing that, no, I'm not satisfied with just obeying the elders. I want my voice to be heard. So it's very important that policymakers, mental health professionals, change the perspective to cater for this change in the way the youth is viewing things, which is having great impact on their mental health. We need to start to look at resourcefulness.
I read somewhere that Nigeria, with 200 million people, has something on the order of 300 psychiatrists. Is that possible?
That's true. And not only that, many of them are leaving right now. So as we train psychiatrists, they're leaving. They're leaving. They're going to Europe. They're going to America. They're going to Australia because of a deep dissatisfaction. Many of them leave, qualify. They're not given the jobs they want immediately. And they really don't see a hope for themselves at this time. A lot of the students I've trained have left and gone. So, and that's true. So that's where resourcefulness comes in. And that was one of the reasons why we had this Center for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, which is a training program. It's a multidisciplinary training program. So you may have a background in literature, a background in geography, because mental health is everybody's problem. And so we bring in multi-professions and train them on an 18-month Master of Science program in child and adolescent mental health. We train them to make assessments. We train them to be able to understand the changing perspectives of mental health on the African continent. We train them on simple psychosocial and psychological interventions. We train them on child rights and leadership so that they can go and train other people, and this will cascade out. And that has really helped because, for example, in Ghana, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, we were very privileged in the Center for Child and Adolescent Mental Health to have trained the first child and adolescent mental health professionals who went back to the country and were able to set up services. Well, even though these services are limited because they are within hospital settings, but they are like an offshoot, a spring. And then people we have trained have also been able to go into schools. They have been able to go into religious center, to mosques, to churches, to carry the message of mental health, that mental health is the wealth of the nation and everyone needs mental health. Mental health is not just about this person that has a mental disorder, but it's about how do I promote the mental health of my community? How do we provide protective factors to prevent young people from having mental disorders? So I think that mental health is, you know, moving out, and it's not just about having psychiatrists, but it's about getting people using the resources that are available. For example, Africans are very religious. All of them will either go to a mosque or to a church. How can we train the imams? How can we train the pastors and people within the churches and the mosques to take care, to understand mental health, to create awareness? How can we get into schools? How do we get into the justice system, into the juvenile justice system, and let the lawyers and the judges understand mental health? I've met a couple of times, had to sit in a place where, you know, within the court. And to me, it was obvious that the person presiding over the court did not understand mental health. So I think it's more about being resourceful rather than looking for the psychiatrist, but looking and trying to get a create awareness in every sector, among the policymakers, among teachers, among the market women. How do I relate to my child so that my child can have a healthy childhood? Because we all know that healthy childhoods leave and are better able to create healthy adults who would be productive.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on talbergfoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Oleanka, let me ask you about stigma. Are people, kids in Nigeria, in sub-Saharan Africa, at risk of being stigmatized because they own up to having mental health issues, to having mental health challenges? And if so, what do you as a professional, what can we do about it? What can you do about it?
Stigma is very, very, very big here in Nigeria and in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'll give a little example. Even when I qualified as a medical doctor in 1986 and decided to become a psychiatrist, I had a lot of opposition from family and friends. They were worried that I would become mentally ill or my behavior would change. And many of them stood against it. And I actually had some who actually threatened, and they were very, very upset. But I stood my ground because I had gone right round the various specialties, rotated through, and I fell in love with psychiatry and mental health. And I felt that mental health was a way in which you look at a person, a whole person, their family, their community, and you can do a lot of good based on my experience as a medical student. And I was talking, that was in 1986, but I was talking recently to some of my students who were doing their residency in psychiatry. One particularly, a young lady who is from Cameroon. And she said to me that her parents, her family are very upset that she has opted for psychiatry. They feel it's highly stigma. I mean, there's a lot of stigma that she may start behaving funny, that it's not a prestigious profession. And of course, that it does not bring in money and so many other things. So she said she has to have a real struggle every time she speaks to them to encourage them and let them know that this is what she wants to do. And there's a lot of help she can be to mankind, to her community, by being a mental health professional. So that is for us. And some of the biggest stigma I have faced has been from colleagues. I remember a couple of years ago, I was asked to go to see a patient on a medical ward. The patient had a cardiac problem, but also had bipolar disorder and was going through a manic episode. And as soon as I got into the ward, one of my colleagues said to me, a medical person, "What are you doing on this ward? We don't like people like you on the ward." And of course, all the other patients turned their eyes to look at where I was going and were whispering to one another. So this is for us who are in the profession, but it's much, much worse for people with a lived experience of mental illness, because I feel the belief system, the causes that we feel, people feel mental illness is because of witchcraft, is as a result of a spiritual attack, it's because they are possessed by demons. In the last couple of years, I've been very privileged to be the Nigerian principal investigator for a grant that is, about, on that grant, we have persons with a lived experience of mental illness working side by side with us. Three of them have actually had episodes of psychosis, mental illness, that is, at different points in their life, they were hearing voices that no one, could hear. Their speech was garbled up and distorted, and they had false beliefs, and they were disorganized, and they were ill. They had to have medication to be able to recover. But there we are, we're working side by side with them in the same office. And some of the experiences they've had about being ostracized by their families. Many of them, some of them were taken to places where they were whipped, where they were beaten. I mean, the experiences that I've had from many of my patients over the years about the kinds of things that happened to them. I'll give another typical example of a young boy, young man who had a psychotic incident, and his family, after we had, you know, he had recovered, they said they were from a royal background, so he must never have that episode again. So he was taken to a church where he was subjected to dry fasting. What that means is that he was not given water or food for several days. Eventually, I believe from what was described to me, he went into a delirium and died. So you find that people lock up their relatives, their loved ones with mental illness behind doors in the home. I've had, you know, they would lock them up and leave because they don't want the neighbors to know because of the belief system. You know, it's so bad that if you have a relative with mental illness and you're about to get married, people may actually go to the side, you know, maybe if you're a young lady wanting to get married and you have maybe a brother or a sibling with mental illness. People may go and tell the family you are going to get married to, because in Africa, it's families that get married, not individuals, and tell them that, look, they have mental illness in that family. You better not go ahead. So the stigma is so high. Even a mother, I know so many instances where a mother would have a baby and have a mental, I mean, about 0.1% of mothers would have a psychosis in the postpartum period after they've had a baby. About another 10% would have depression. The relatives will come and take the baby away and say the mother should not breastfeed because she would transmit the illness through her breast milk to her child. So these are the various battles that we as mental health professionals have had to fight at every stage to get people to see that mental illness is treatable, is manageable, that people with mental illness, if loved and supported, can thrive and they can participate fully in society. But I must say that the stigma is so high. And that is why most people with mental illness in Africa, the first point of call is not the hospital. It is either a religious center or traditional healer's place. That is where people go when they're ill, because that is where the communities believe they can get respite and treatment. Not to say that the services are very rare. That's another topic, that there are problems about services.
But as a mental health professional, as a very accomplished mental health professional, you've got to work with that reality. You've got to work with the reality of the culture, of what the communal response is, as you pointed out quite eloquently. Africa is a family-oriented, much more so than the West. How do you use that reality? I know you've been working with the Succeed Africa Project, that you're central to the Succeed Africa Project, and specifically looking for new kinds of interventions that leverage those realities. Would you talk a bit about what you've found so far and the kinds of solutions that you think can work?
Yeah. I think in Africa, and I'll say Nigeria in my context, some of our biggest resources are the family. The government social services don't really work. So I would not, for now, hopefully in the years to come, things will get better. The families are the caregivers to persons with a lived experience of mental illness. And when you see a person with mental illness on the road, and there are many of them, if you drive around my city, you will see many people almost stark naked, dirty, living on the streets, carrying garbage around. Very, very sad. Many times it's not an issue of there's no treatment. It's because the support system has broken, or the belief system and the person has been sent away from home. I remember very clearly there was a young girl, 7 years old, who had been brought by her mother to this city where I live, from another city. I live in Ibadan. And the mother abandoned her under a bridge and said, "I'm coming back," a seven-year-old girl, and left and never came back. And so the girl was picked up by, you know, people who noticed she was roaming around and crying. To cut a long story short, they took her to the juvenile justice home, but they were eventually able to track the mother. The mother said she was told to abandon her by the community, by the leaders in the community, the traditional leader, because the girl was a witch. And, you know, when we carried out our assessment, we found that the girl had a psychotic illness. She would talk to herself. She would laugh to herself. She was hearing voices. But the community had banished her because they did not understand that what she had was a mental illness and was, you know, something that could be treatable. So one of the ways in which we are dealing with the stigma is, first of all, to have people with the lived experience of psychosis who have recovered tell their stories. And so there's nothing as powerful. And that's one of the best experiences I've had working on the Succeed Africa group, where I lead the Nigerian project, because we're working in Malawi, we're in Zimbabwe, in Sierra Leone, which is my mother's country. So I've been a couple of times on this grant, and of course Nigeria, and then of course the London School in the United Kingdom. We have peer researchers. They are people who have suffered psychosis. They're still on medication. And we have watched them on this project, where they are treated with dignity and respect and have a regular income, a regular livelihood. We've watched them blossom and flourish. In fact, two of them on my team have been able to get married and to have children, which is, in one of the ways in African culture, that's one of the things that you as a woman are to aspire for. And evidence that you are participating in society is that you've gotten married and you can have children. So we have these peer researchers go out and tell their stories. I remember we had a couple of outreaches to change the perspective of communities. And initially, there were people who had mental illness there who did not want to come out. But when the peer researchers came out and said, "You know, I had mental illness. I am still on medication. Sometimes it comes back. But look at me." We found that people and families with relatives with mental health conditions came out. That was very, very powerful. And one of the things that Succeed Africa is doing is that we have people with a lived experience who are described as peer support workers. So they are going to be looking after people with mental illness in the community. We're getting people with a lived experience. So that's one of the best things I feel has happened, supported by community support workers and supervisors. Another very important aspect we've found is that livelihood, that many times when people don't have livelihood, because livelihood does so much more. It gives you respect in the family, gives you self-respect, it builds off self-esteem. When people have a livelihood, they are more likely to strive hard, to stay well, to use their medications, to go for their appointment. Another grant that I'm working with is the Transform Grant, which is very, very exciting too, because it's looking at partnerships with traditional healers and faith-based healers. So we've co-produced training programs with traditional healers and faith imams, the Muslim leaders and pastors in churches. And we are working with them to see how they can refer. We're not taking their patients from them, but they're trying to get them to refer patients to us so that we can carry out the biomedical aspect. But another thing we've done is to kind of, with reciprocal learning, listen to them and get them to listen to us about issues, about violence, because we know many times they chain down patients, they flog them. So listening to them and their perspective and giving them a voice, partnering with them. And I must say that we're not totally there yet, but we've had a lot of excellent results so far because they want to be heard and we are giving them that voice and partnering with them. Yeah.
It sounds to me like working practical definitions of a word you used earlier, resourcefulness.
Yeah.
That you are trying to look at what actually happens and develop interventions, protocols, practices that are consistent with those realities and trying to bend the arc as opposed to impose something totally new.
Absolutely.
My last question, because we're running short of time, is how do you create for your country more urgency, more recognition that if you don't solve, and I don't, solve is the wrong word, if you don't address the mental health issues with urgency, the future is going to be even more difficult than the present.
One of my biggest, I would say, a leader without followers, or I would say successors, people who have bought my vision and are running with it with a faster pace. I think I'm grateful for that. One of the non-governmental organizations that is having great impact on Nigeria and indeed on the entire African continent is ACIDO. ACIDO is an advocating voice primarily on social media, where they have programs to educate people about mental illness, where they have programs whereby people with mental illness come and speak. They've been at the center working with the Association for Psychiatrists in Nigeria. And after so many years, I must say that in just as the last government was leaving office in 2023, the Nigeria, eventually, the Mental Health Act was signed into law. Before then, we had the Mental Health Act that was left in place in the 18th century by the British, which had words like lunatic and asylum. This was a collective effort of many people, and many of them were people that had passed through my training. And I think that's a success. When your own people you have trained, because the Center for Child and Adolescent Mental Health is not just an ordinary program. We're training leaders for the African continent, people who would believe that Africa will eventually rise and that it's going to take our collective efforts. I have other students who are in different parts of Africa with the same loud voice, speaking to their governments, advocating, training others so that there's a cascading out effect. The leadership of the African Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, the president, the vice president, the secretary, the treasurer, are all products and all of them trained in the Center for Child and Adolescent Mental Health. So it's, even though the task is so hard, when you have many people sending out the same message, then the impact cascades out. Right now, there's a strong push to get the government of my country to remove suicide as a crime. As it is today, if you attempt suicide and you're caught, it's punishable with 1 year imprisonment. So there, those are, you know, very, very sad aspects that are still in place. But it is the voices that of people that have been able to train people, medical students who have passed through our training, master's students, students who have gone through our residency training programs. But then my own voice is as loud as can be. Every time I get the opportunity, I would speak very loudly.
Dr. Omokboden, I want to say three things. One of the things we love, that I love at the Telberg Foundation, is loud voices. So to the extent we can help amplify those loud voices on these terribly important issues, we'd like to do so. Secondly, thank you for this conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our audience has. And finally, thank you for the work you're doing, because this, as you've just said, if we don't get this right, if you don't get this right, the consequences, not just today, but as far as we can see, are awful. So please keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Alan. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.